Joe Hudson is an executive coach, connection teacher, and someone I have learned so much from. We talk about five of the most regrettable and costly mistakes I was consistently making in my relationships, how those were costing me and probably you in life and business, and how Joe's unique approach can resolve those mistakes so that you see massive positive changes today. I thought it'd be interesting, because I've watched a lot of your interviews, to start with the things that I have taken from your work, because my audience and I are often so super aligned on these things. And I'd love to start with one that I thought was one of my biggest strengths that has turned out to be, let's say, a mistake or a flaw or incomplete. And that is my identification with the savior in the victim, bully, savior triangle. I professionally give advice to people. I privately give advice to people. I'm constantly trying to make myself useful and helpful in interactions and conversation. And I thought that this was like the key to who I was and my power. And I think it was from you was the first person that made me realize there's a whole other side of that that I would love if you could sort of dive into.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to that. So I would say the first piece is that oftentimes when we're being helpful to somebody, we're telling somebody that they're not capable of doing it themselves. So, which is why so many relationships that we get into are like, if you come from that place, start creating resentment. Either they feel resentful towards you, or if it's long-term, short-term, it's different. But if it's long-term, they start feeling resentful towards you, or you feel like some sense of obligation to be helpful, and then you start feeling resentful for them. And it's because, you know, we'd like a relationship where one person's always taking care of another person or always taking care of them in one particular thing. It just creates a dynamic of where people aren't empowered. And so that's kind of part of it. The other part of it is oftentimes we're doing it because we're like, oh, I want to be helpful. But really the underneath thing is that I'm scared that you won't like me. I'm scared that you won't love me. I'm doing something to keep you happy because somehow I think my happiness is going to be determined by your happiness with me. Which is very disempowering to the self as well.
Yeah. One of the huge ahas where it fell into place with me was when you were talking about fight, flight, or freeze and how those mapped onto victim, savior, bully. And that savior is flight. And for me, that was so, I was like, wait, savior is flight. How is savior flight? And you unpacked it and it clicked with me. So I'd love for you to share that.
So great. So the thing is that there's this thing, they call it the drama triangle. So you can do a whole bunch of work on, like go out into the internet and look up the drama triangle. We call it the fear triangle. Mm. And so the fear triangle, we say it's the fear triangle because it's all based in fear. In the drama triangle, they call it bully, savior, victim. And then there's like some other triangle that's like, it's the same thing, but it's like, it's not the same thing. And so we call it coaching or blah, blah, blah. There's all this stuff. To me, the real deal is like, if you're scared, you're going to either bully somebody to feel like you're more in control again. You're going to freeze. Like, you feel like those people out there who are like, oh, I feel stuck in life. I feel like I can't make a decision, or somebody gets mad at me and I don't, like, I didn't know what to say. I just sat there, that whole thing. That's the freeze. And then the flight is when you fly away from yourself into somebody else. And then you're like, oh, hey, I'm going to fix you so that I can be okay. And what's amazing is like, I just did this thing. I was at a company and we were working with like 100 managers and we were in this huge room. I was like, okay, everybody who has a tendency to do fight, do go over to this corner, and flight, go over to this corner. And the way that they dealt with fear, what happens is that everybody feels like the other person is like attacking them. So the people who are likely to be in that bully mode, if somebody's like, I'm out of here, they feel totally abandoned. They feel left alone. If the person who is savior mode and the bully is there and they're like getting angry at the savior, like, hey, can't you see I'm trying to help you? Like, you know, and then if the person who freezes, it's all of them trigger each other in their response to the fear, which is amazing. So they're all scared. They're all trying to manage their fear in one way or another. And then they're all triggering each other. And so it's like, this is what causes the drama. But I think the underlying, I know the underlying thing is the fear that's really driving the behavior. That's not to say. So then what people say is, oh, I need to stop being scared. I need to stop acting from fear. And that's like, that doesn't work. So the way to go about it is to start looking forward to your fear, to seek to understand your fear, to learn how the fear operates in your body, how it makes your mind think binary thoughts instead of, you know, a range of thoughts, how you think you have to make decisions when you're scared, and just start understanding fear. And then you start looking forward to it, because typically if somebody is in a place of fear, there's some way in which they're not being true to themselves. Mm-hmm. And so if they can actually be true to themselves, then a whole nother thing changes and the drama just disappears.
Got it. So before we go into sort of the solve for this, I noticed that with particularly, I guess with all of them to a degree, maybe a little bit less with Savior, it's hard to identify yourself in these patterns. Like when you're in victimhood, you're not like, I'm being a victim. You're like, this person is attacking me. And when you're in Savior, you're like, this person is doing something wrong and I'm here to help them. And when you're in Bully, it's like, no one gets it. I've got to take charge. And so I'm curious. Right. I mean, that's my broad understanding. What are some ways that people might be able to recognize inside of themselves when they've dropped into this, but they're in a bit of self-delusion as to what's actually occurring inside of them?
Yeah, that's great. So usually so some people are aware of the emotions they're having, some people aren't, and it's depending on how much emotional abuse they had as a kid. And so if you're aware of your emotions, that's a great way. If you're feeling obligation, you're in Savior, you've been in Savior for a while. If you're feeling like I'm all alone in this, you've been in Bully for a while. If you feel stuck, you've been in victim for a while.
That's
the emotional way to know right away where you're at. I think intellectually, the bully is usually very self-reliant. They'll have thoughts about like, it's only I can do it. I need to be in control. Nobody gets the job done in the right way without me doing it. That's far more the bully. They when they feel hurt, they're going to get angry. So that hurt is going to create anger in them. And it's interesting because what they're really doing in that form of anger, though most people don't get it, is it's actually a form of vulnerability. They're saying, I'm like so out of control. I feel so out of control that it's like tears for them, which is a really fascinating thing. And when you see that, it's amazing. I'll give you an example. I had one of my clients was working with one of the like most notable Silicon Valley narcissists who would just come in and just start yelling at, you know, when things weren't going right. And really competent, really amazing human, and had this propensity. And one day she looked at him and she said, hey, I see that you feel all alone in this. And I want you to know everybody here is very much wants to help you, and that we know that you see something and some wisdom that we don't see. However, when you're yelling, it makes it harder for us to help you. And she and her team never got yelled at again.
Wow.
Because when the person's in that, what they need is they need to feel like they can be held, like their anger is not going to scare you away. Like, oh, hey, yeah, you're angry. I get it. Like, here's the thing behind it. I get it. I see that. And you're not scaring me. Then they can trust you. But if they yell and they get angry and you run, it's like if I cried in front of you and you're like, fuck off, I'm out of here, then I'm not going to cry in front of you again. I'm not going to feel safe around you. Similarly with the anger. And so yeah, that's one way to know if you're in the anger. If you're in the victim, there's going to be a lot of blame. There's going to be a lot of feeling of stuckness. There's also going to be like a lot of if only thought process.
Yeah.
If only I can't be, but, and the can't never like looks at the because it's, I can't, there's because I don't want a potential consequence is usually the because, but you don't look at that. It's just, I can't.
Yeah.
And so that's a lot of stuckness is there. And then with the Savior, it's just a lot of trying to make people happy, trying to help other people, getting a lot of that value that never actually feels really satisfying of helping other people. There's something that I do want to say, though. We are naturally generous. Like if we feel happy and healed, like we naturally want to give. So I'm not saying in any way that, oh, if you're like giving is bad or being generous is bad or being loving is bad. I'm not saying anything of that. I'm saying if you're helping people without a direct ask, without them saying, like if you're answering questions that haven't been asked, if you're going in and trying to solve people's problems without them saying, hey, I would like your help solving problems, then you're like, it's very disempowering.
Yeah.
A great example of this is I was hanging out in Nicaragua when like it was just opening up for Western tourism. And there's a whole bunch of Canadians down there who were like, we're helping people. And they brought this shipping container full of clothes and they were giving them to locals. And I was like, oh, like, what are you doing? They told me, I said, it feels like what you're doing is you're teaching them that like they need to be given to, like where's the exchange of energy that teaches them that, oh, here's how you can make things happen. They're like, well, there's nothing that they could give to us. I was like, oh, how about like saving the turtles? Mm-hmm. Like how about like helping the environment? How about like, and I gave them like 30 ideas of like things that they could do mm-hmm. that would help them. And there would be an exchange of energy. And you could see the looks on their faces where it was like, the difference was I'm here to make myself feel better and feel like I've done some good instead of I'm here to empower people. Mm. And I know, you know, the quote, but it's that quote of, if you're here to help me, no, thank you. If you're here to work together for our mutual freedom, let's get to work. Mm. Which is a quote from a tribe. I believe it's in Ecuador.
I'd love to ask about this. So this is, I've, you know, I tried to be charitable and I was, you know, doing more than my 10% to this. Yeah. This has been a tricky one for me. I just read The Prophet by Khalil Gibran. It's so beautiful. Yeah. It made me cry. I was just like, this is just gorgeous.
Yeah.
He talks about giving in there, and he talks about giving with an open hand and giving to those regardless of whether they deserve. And I'm wondering how this interacts, this recognition of the value in some transactional energetic exchange and that just pure open-handed, I expect nothing in return. Because they both feel valuable and true to me.
Yeah, I don't see the distinction between them.
Interesting. Okay, so the distinction as I see it, when I think of giving open-handedly, it's like, you don't have to give me anything back. I'm giving to you not because you've done anything to earn or deserve this, but because you don't have a shirt on your back and here is the shirt. And in the energetic exchange, sort of like you described, like what can you add to my life or to the world or to the community? And it seems like there needs to be something given back. So they seem to me contradictory, and I'd love to hear your perspective on
it. Well, I don't think they have to give back to you. Mm-hmm. I think that's partially the situation, is like you can give with an open hand or an open heart, and there's no, that you don't have to assume anything, like any kind of an exchange that way. Mm-hmm. One is speaking to the internal state, and the other one is speaking to how to make giving effective. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's the main thing. The other thing is, it's like if you are looking for an exchange for yourself, like, oh, hey, I'm giving in an exchange for myself. Mm-hmm. One of the ways that we do that is so that I can feel safe, so that I can feel good about myself, mm-hmm. so I can feel valued. All those are not giving with an open hand.
Got it. And that's how I gave. I gave to discharge the endless guilt that I feel and have felt constantly simmering beneath the surface for not. Right. Yeah. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. So that's what's not open-handed about it. If you're giving out of the pure joy of giving.
Understood.
That's a different thing.
Yes. Okay. That was the unhealthy part of that. There was an exchange, but it was, I don't know, some sort of toxic exchange where I allowed myself to feel my own innocence for a moment. Got it.
I'll give you a great story of that. This is kind of an interesting story, and it has to do with The Prophet, which just made me think. So I have a buddy who, he's my, the godfather of, not godfather like Catholic, but basically kind of the spiritual father, like the person who we were like, if we die, we want you to take care of our daughter, one of our daughters. And so that's him. And I met him when I was like creating a rock and roll album in like the middle of the desert. And he was restoring 5,000 acres of natural habitat on the lower Colorado River. So we're out one day driving around and he sees this guy who's a hobo. And he like sits down, just starts talking to him and just is like, hey, and like doesn't treat him in any ways, not there to give to him. He just like chats. It's like, hey, what's going on? Cause the guy was living in this encampment in this place that was going to be restored. And so like it meant that his home was going to leave. Mm-hmm. So he sits down, he's just talking to him. The guy's name was Lucky. And, you know, I don't know, like an hour later, he's like, you want a job? Guy's like, yeah, I want a job. It's like, great. You're going to help us restore this area. You know, you can't live here, but like, we're going to. And so they start working together and Lucky found another encampment that he could, and like this whole thing. And he hadn't had a job in a while. And it was just this really beautiful exchange. And then at the end of our time together, Lucky had nothing except for this duffel bag full of shit that, you know, clothes or whatever. And he reaches in the bottom and he has this leather bound copy of The Prophet. And he hands it to my friend. He's like, this is the last thing that I own, from my brother, from my family. It's the last piece of possession that I have that's like from my heritage, and I want you to have it.
Wow.
That had the energetic exchange, but it also was open giving in both sides.
I hear right? that. Yeah. That's beautiful.
Yeah. It was even in my friend's approach to just sit down with him and talk to him and say, what's going on with you? And what's your world like? And what do you need? And like treating him like a human, not like somebody to help.
That is a beautiful segue to another one. Listening. This is one that I've gotten. So I've made hundreds of YouTube videos and I've made them on interpersonal skills, and they're all about talking. They're all about how what to say to make people, and you know, it's done well. What to say to the girl, what to say to the guy who you're trying to get a promotion from, what to say, and there's effective strategies in there for sure.
Yeah, of course.
But then you've got a quote that was just sort of flipped, turned upside down, which is, listening is one of the most, if not the most effective ways to affect your reality. And that was not immediately obvious to me. I was like, no, talking is the most obvious is the way to affect your reality. So I'd love to dive into it because, I mean, I could share my own experience after, but it's been a big difference of like, I guess I was almost I was talking to a simulation to a degree. It's like I was interfacing with my projection of the world. And it's like, well, okay, I don't care how good you are at persuading. Try to persuade something that isn't actually there tricky. Versus listening is like, oh, I'm making contact with what is actually real when I speak. But I'd love to hear you talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, listening is so important that we have people who train with us for coaching and the first 8 months is all about listening. Mm-hmm. That's how deeply we go into it. So every person I've ever met wants to be heard and seen more than they want to be persuaded, or impressed. That's the basics behind what makes listening so powerful is that like, you sit down and you see somebody clearly and they feel seen by you, which is a rare gift in this world. And that's it. It's over. Like you have a friend. The technical thing is like in business, if you listen well, people share different things with you. Mm-hmm. So one boss can come in and listen one way and they're going to get one set of information, and another boss listens another way and they're going to get a different set of information. So that's just also true. And so the more deeply that you listen, the more vulnerable people become, the more you are willing to love and accept them for who they are, the more that they're going to tell you their truth. And so now you're not just dealing with what reality is, you're dealing with like the truth that drives the people that you're sitting across from.
Yeah.
And so that's amazing. So a story I have on that is I was hanging out, I was a venture capitalist at the time, and I'm sitting with a person who starts to pitch me, but we sit down, we're talking, we're having this very nice conversation. And then the person starts to pitch me. And I was like, I just noticed my entire body constricted when you started to pitch me. And I don't like, that's not the relationship I want with you. I'm wondering what's happening for you.
Mm.
And he was like, yeah, I feel like I can't be myself in the pitch. And like, we had this like incredibly long, deep conversation. It's because that conversation that he was, this person ran this, something called a, what was it? It's like trans tech. He ran trans tech at the time, but he also ran these meetup for trans tech. And so he's like, hey, can you come and talk? And then I started talking, and then all of a sudden people, more and more people wanted to coach with me. And then that's actually what started this business, was because I was listening deeply to him and to myself. There was no way I could have like impressed him enough for him to like spend literally the next 3 years introducing me to all the groups that he ran, that he could run across the country. So yeah, just that's an example of it. But it's also just fucking so much more enjoyable.
Yeah.
You know, like, to like listen with an open heart is quite a pleasure. And thinking that you have to manipulate the world to what end, you know, like, oh, I impress you to what end so that you like me. But if I feel like I had to impress you for you to like me, then you don't actually like me. You like the thing that I presented to impress you. So it never fully satisfies.
Yeah.
And not to say there aren't great techniques of talking, and there's a lot of wonderful things in that. But even to know when to use the technique is based more on listening than it is on the technique.
One of the things that you said that I've want to make sure that to highlight for the audience is that I don't know how I could have felt this before I experienced it, but like the organ of listening is, it's kind of like your whole body, and it, you know, particularly your heart. And I know that the way that I listened before was sort of with my mind, which was to say superficial, which is what they're saying true? Does that match, you know, what do I have to say in response to this? Does this remind me of something? Versus what you're describing is like, you noticed your body tense, which is listening to them and also listening to what's occurring neck down inside of you, and then and speaking it. That combination of listening, which is, and I've heard you say this, like the listening isn't listening if you're not listening to yourself, which was a really helpful thing for someone like me who can go into Savior and be like, what about you? What about you? What about you? Yeah,
exactly.
And so I just wanted to make sure that I highlighted that.
Yeah. The way I think about that is if you're playing sports from the head up, you're going to suck. Like, literally, like if I'm playing pickleball and I'm like thinking about the next move instead of in my body, the next move is probably not going to go as well. The next move happens naturally if I'm listening to the whole, but if I'm listening to just my mind, then I'm going to think about it, but I'm not going to execute on it well. Or if I'm playing music and I'm like thinking about what's going to happen next, instead of being in the moment and feeling the music and listening to it with my whole body, it's going to suck. It's not going to be as good as if I'm like listening to it with my whole body. And it's the exact same thing in a conversation. It's it's not just the mind, it's the whole body.
Yeah.
But the thing is, most people just do it from the mind. So they have to learn the body part for a while and then they can integrate all of it.
So let's, to give the mind its due, the thing that I love about the mind is control. Like and I love control, and I love to try to squeeze things. And I knew that when I was first doing this, what is so scary about the body is the lack of control that it has. So like, you know, if you feel your body during a conversation or a movie or in anything, you might cry. You might you might do all sorts of things that were for me no-go zones. Yeah. For a while. And so I think this is like a good segue into, I guess it was, I saw tremendous value and still want to speak to, I guess, like people do respond to invulnerability to a degree. Like when I look at someone like a Donald Trump or an Andrew Tate, there's an aura of invulnerability that people gravitate towards. And so to move completely over to the other side of vulnerability is, it's a scary leap, but I've also seen incredible value in my relationships from doing that, from not finding the tear, allowing the tears that are there to emerge in front of someone. And so one question that I haven't fully resolved is like, you know, it seems like there's effective outcomes that people are able to get from invulnerability, which is what makes it attractive. And there's really effective outcomes that come from vulnerability. So I'm just wondering how you understand that and why vulnerability is the one that you've directed your life towards.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I mean, the second part of the answer is easy. It's just far more enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you might notice about people who make their living being invulnerable is that they're almost constantly in a fight.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were like, yeah, I want a life where I'm constantly in a fight, then invulnerability is fantastic.
Yeah.
It turns out that it's not just an external fight. You're constantly in a fight with yourself. Mm-hmm. So if you're like, hey, I want to be in a constant fight with myself, invulnerability is also great. So that's the reason. What makes invulnerability work? Well, the question is, what does working mean?
Mm.
Like it works to control people.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a certain amount of control over people that you can get definitely with invulnerability. And the reason that that works is because it's sometimes really scary to own the fact that you there's not an end all be all. Here's the solution. Here's the answer. Here's the right way to do things.
Mm.
And so it's really appealing to someone who's like, I'm right. This is the way. I know this thing and this is the truth. And it's like, oh, that's really appealing. I now don't have to think. I don't have to actually listen to myself, and which is the real thing underneath it. So like, if you look at my kids, our entire way of raising them was, we trust that if you listen to yourself, you'll be great people. That's our trust, is that if you just learn how to listen to yourself. So like, we never punished our kids. We shamed them occasionally, but only because we were having a momentary lapse of sanity. But there was like very little shaming of our children. There was no punishment of our children. Our children are like amazingly giving human beings, not codependent. Like they're just like, they're awesome. And on our podcast, you know, I assume you've listened mm-hmm. to like my conversations with my daughter. And so what's happened is that if you aren't given that, if you're not afforded that reality where you're like, oh, hey, the important thing is to listen to yourself. Instead, the important thing is to listen to me. That's what you know love to be. That's what you know safety to be. And so you just continue to go and listen to the next person. And so the biggest predictor of somebody who will vote for Donald Trump is somebody who had an authoritarian parent.
Mm.
Authoritarian. I don't, can't remember which of the words, but basically a parent who was like, this is how you do things and you're going to do it. And da, da, da. Those are the people who vote for Donald Trump because it gives them a sense of safety.
Mm.
And so yeah, that can work as far as like, but what's the working? Like then you end up, but like Donald Trump, mm-hmm. like if that's working for you, hell yeah, go do it. To me, that's not working. Like that level of self-abuse and not being able to care for myself or the people around me, not being able to be effective, you know, like having to like not work half of your presidency because your mind is beating you up so fucking badly that you know, et cetera.
Mm.
That's not working for me.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that, just to be clear, I'm not I don't want to say that I am for or against Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying I don't want to be like Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But I'm not for or against Donald Trump or for or against any presidential candidate. We're all human and we all have our things. But I haven't really seen any president honestly really use vulnerability in the way that they could use vulnerability to get. And there's this great psychological test that they did where they basically had somebody super charismatic and get up and like make a presentation perfectly. And then they did the same thing, perfect presentation, but then they tripped on the way out. And the person who tripped was like so much more liked. Mm. It was like some crazy amount of extra people liked them because they were human.
And probably coupled with that charisma as well. When there's that admiration piece and also humanity, I think those Versus if it's a bumbling person that falls on the way out, it's just like that just is a hard no at that point.
Correct. That's exactly what the test, if I recall correctly, that's exactly what the test showed.
Yeah. So
that's right.
With one of the things that I don't know how much you know about Andrew Tate, but he had his jail time stint after stuff, and it's what I've noticed is that strong man invulnerable, it's suited to particular environments where it's like almost, I don't want to say it's the best way of being, but it's like the most obviously accessible best way of being when there's a fight. And like you said, the problem is that if you don't update to your current surroundings, you can carry the fight forward throughout your life constantly. And so when I look at those people that have that invulnerable, there's a degree of invulnerable charisma, it's often that they were in like fights when they were growing up. There was really a lot of tension,
right.
And they weren't, you know, even when they got to the penthouse, they weren't able to put it down and be like, oh, I made it out. You know, I don't have to do it that way. And in doing that, they attract people, circumstances, all sorts of things that keep them in the fight and keep them going, I have to be like this. Because otherwise, like if Donald Trump were to just flip today and go in front of the judge and be like, let me just tell you what I did. I don't think there's going to be a huge debt for him to pay, that that invulnerability debt, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that was my childhood, right? So when I was at the table in my teen years, my dad would yell at me for like an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, okay, dad, you're right. He said, see, I told you you're fucking weak. You quit. You know, like that was the reality of my, and so I grew up like that. I grew up fighting all the time. I got kicked out of my first college because I was growing up fighting. So I totally relate and understand it. And I don't really think the best way to be is strong. It's the only way to be when you're a kid and that's happening to you, because otherwise you're going to lose your whole sense of identity and you're going to suffer from some form of psychosis. I think you have to hold on to something that is you. And if you don't, it's really quite detrimental, whether it's aggressively doing it or passive aggressively holding on to it. I think it's a really important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I agree. But as far as updating, I think that's trauma in general, like whatever trauma that we suffer. And I don't mean trauma like with a, like war trauma, though that's great, or car accident trauma. I mean, just like all the ways we weren't attuned to as kids. Like that, the thing about trauma is like take somebody from Iraq as an example. They're in Cleveland. They were in Iraq. They're now in Cleveland. A car backfires and they're back in Fallujah, right? Like they're thinking that they're in the war. That's how trauma works, is when we hit our traumatized state, we go back to the place where it happened and we think that's the reality that we're looking in. And the thing about trauma on the emotional side of it is that every time we suffer that trauma, we're taught not to feel a certain emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And so the solution to getting out of a trauma state is to feel the emotion that got stuck there, that wasn't allowed to be felt, right? Like the thing Andrew Tate couldn't do, or I couldn't do, was, or Donald Trump potentially couldn't do, I'm assuming, I don't know these people well enough to say, but is it like to say, fuck, this hurts.
Yeah.
This sucks. I'm like, could you please stop hurting me?
Yeah.
It wasn't allowed in my house. There's no fucking way you could have done that.
Mm-hmm.
And so like to just allow myself to feel the hurt underneath the anger, the fear underneath the anger, the sadness underneath the helplessness underneath the anger, all of that was what I needed to do to get out of that pattern of constantly recreating fights.
Would love to. So this is something, when people ask me advice, I've noticed my advice has shifted increasingly in the direction of what you're saying, which is like, feel the thing that you're trying to avoid.
Yeah.
When I look back at my early breakthroughs, and I don't know if this is a stage thing, it was like, don't feel the thing, use the thing that you're trying to avoid as jet fuel to propel you in a different direction. So for instance, I was very shy and spent many years avoiding the girl that I most liked. And the frustration and the pain of going home and kicking myself became that, like, I am not going to go home again and just beat myself up all day. So I'm going to go and at least try to talk to her, which became, in a way to use that avoiding experience to propel me in a direction of growth at that stage in my life.
Yes.
I don't know what would have happened at that stage if I was like, maybe it could have worked if I'd had a more supportive environment. Like, feel the self-reproach that you're going to have when you go home. And I'm curious, when you're working with people, is it a stages thing where it's like people who come to you have already burned out a lot of their avoidance and they're ready for a different way? I've struggled when people ask for advice because I'm looking at my own story. It's like, look, there's about 30 years of just like jet fuel avoidance that got me to a particular place in life. And and I don't want to cheat you out of that by saying where I'm at now. So I'm curious what you think about that.
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think you can do both simultaneously.
Okay.
So I don't think the first thing, that using it as jet fuel doesn't require the avoidance is another way to say it.
Okay.
So when people feel their anger and they have that clean experience of expression of anger, it leads to determination. Mm. If people really feel their helplessness in something like with the girl, mm-hmm. my experience is that it leads to them feeling more empowered and more capable.
Mm.
So I think it is. The only difference is that to do it by feeling the emotion, it sets it up so that the pattern doesn't repeat. So that first girlfriend where you're really scared and then you like showed up and you finally did it and you had the conversation with her, and it's like, how many times did you have to then continue to like either show up in a, like say your truth that was scary, mm-hmm. that you might lose her over and over again, and then you didn't show up the way that you wanted to, and then she left or you left because you weren't in a relationship, an actual relationship with each other. Or so you either had to fight that pattern consistently over and over and over again, or the pattern got you eventually and the relationship didn't work out the way that you had in your mind. And so to me, it's about both. Is you don't use the idea of feeling your emotion as a reason not to take the action that you know is true. It's mm-hmm. the opposite. You feel the emotion as a way to become aligned with the action. And the reason that works is because what we're actually trying to avoid is emotional experience. We're not trying to actually avoid the reality of. Mm-hmm. So if I said, look, hey man, you're going to be homeless. And right now you'd be like, oh, that's a little scary. I don't want that. Right. But if I said, hey, look, you're going to be homeless, but I guarantee you're going to be happier than you've ever been. You're going to have insights that are unbelievably amazing. The relationships that you're going to have are going to like make the best ones you have today feel dwarfed. Like, you're going to feel fucking great being homeless. It's going to be amazing. And if you knew that to be true, like, what happens to the fear of being homeless?
It becomes a desire to be homeless.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Right? And so it's what we're really scared of is an emotional state. So if you feel the emotional state before mm-hmm. you take the action, then there's no more fear of the action.
Mm.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Mm. So an example of this would be like, my wife and I have been married now for 20 some years. And 3 or 4 times in our, maybe even more, I'm not good with counting stuff. But there's been several times in our relationship where things aren't going well. Mm-hmm. And I notice I'm not taking the action that I need to take or saying the things that I need to say or being truthful to myself in the way that I want to be truthful because I'm scared of losing the marriage. So I grieve the marriage. She's done the same thing, and we just grieve it as if it's over.
Wow.
And then we can show up. Then we can be ourselves because we've already suffered the thing that we don't want to suffer. And then everything works out.
That is so counter how most people do it. There is an unwillingness. And by the way, I've felt it in many of my relationships. Like I can't consider, think, or even allow myself to feel that this thing could be let go. I think because the belief is that in not going there psychologically or emotionally, that's how I create my safety, is if I just never let myself feel that feeling, it'll never happen and then it'll be okay.
Except it works the exact opposite.
Yeah, this is a great chance maybe to talk about golden algorithm, which is, I guess for our audience, maybe start by listening, accepting, and then testing it in your own life, and you can check. And it's
correct.
Because at first it's like, no, that's not how it works. And then you're like, wait a second.
Exactly. Yeah. Before we go there, I just want to say something that it seems to me that, like, if I just look at your personal like journey as you're describing it, which is, you know, the listening and other things that you're doing, like feeling the emotions, is like creating these tears, creating this like mm-hmm. this thing of vulnerability. And Like that's generally how it works. So the meaning that if you show up and you start listening to yourself and listening to others, if you show up and you say, oh, there's some emotions that I'm not feeling, that I'm now going to be open to feeling, then these emotions start moving. And then all of a sudden you see things more clearly because you're now looking at the whole, as you said, you're looking at reality. You're looking at the whole story of the situation. And the idea that, oh, I can avoid this one, I can say, I'm not going to look at this one part of reality and that's going to make me more effective, is like an investor saying, I can like not look at like the currency exchange of the yen versus the dollar, and I'm going to be a successful currency trader. It's like the idea that it makes no sense. And so how does it work? The golden algorithm is basically every emotion that you're avoiding, you're inviting to experience in the exact way that you're avoiding it. So because I had a father who was like my father and my mother like my mother, emotional abandonment was my pattern. And so I was in a traumatic state. Every time anything bad would happen in a relationship, I would land in that traumatic shape of I'm being abandoned right now. So I would see it when it wasn't there. I would manipulate it to be there, you know, and I'd prove that it was there even when it wasn't there. And so somebody would say, have a problem with me, which is going to happen in a relationship. And I'd be like, okay, I'm getting abandoned now. And I don't want to fucking feel that. So I'd harden up. I'd cross my arms and like, oh, blah, 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 blah. Which makes it really fucking easy, if not better, for people to abandon you at that moment because you're being a prick, right? Like, so that was one way that, and the other way that I would do it is I would try to save them. Oh, let me, if I can do this and this and this, and I can make my alcoholic father happy, then maybe like I won't be abandoned. And then that created resentment, and then they would abandon me, like it just like a longer thing. So every single way that I looked to avoid that feeling invited that feeling in. And I highly recommend reverse engineer it for yourself. Say, oh, what's the pattern that keeps on happening in my life? What's the emotion that I'm feeling? How do I avoid feeling it? And then how does that invite this pattern into my life? And it's as obvious as day once you see it.
Yeah. There's so many for me, but a core one is being bad. The amount of things I did to try to avoid feeling bad, like I am bad or was bad.
Yes.
I was a philosophy major with an emphasis on the moral philosophy. And then I figured out what the right amount to give what to charity, and then gave gave more just to be safe. Yeah. And what it did, and the way that it invited back into my life, is particularly like take business. When it came time to when people weren't doing good work, I would take, this is my fault. You know, I haven't trained them well enough. I haven't communicated clear enough. I haven't done all of this.
Yeah.
And so now I'm retaining people that I'm getting frustrated with, and now I'm not treating them nicely as humans, you know, because I'm trying to be nice to them in work, and I'm letting my resentment slip out in human person to person interaction, which now I'm feeling bad about. And it was just like this whole ecosystem of frothing badness that I was experiencing, keeping me up at night, wishing I'd done something differently, swearing to God I was going to do it differently the next day. And then struggling so hard in the moment and almost never succeeding at it.
Right. Which was more evidence that you were bad.
Exactly. And which meant I needed more control. I need to add additional layers of accountability and shame. And I wouldn't have called it shame. Additional control mechanisms in order to really squeeze myself into doing the right thing.
Right.
And so as I started peeling those back, holy scary, so scary to start stripping those control mechanisms away. But what I found, and it was like one-to-one, as I did that, the thing that unlocked my, they moved together, my ability to like let go of one particular person that it was just clearly not aligned and wasn't right, was in the same interaction. I had to feel how much I loved him and communicate that to him and be like, this is so scary for me because I love you so much. And it was just oh my God, everything worked in that interaction.
Yeah. How long until he thanked you?
Immediately.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Sean Nelson, founder and CEO of LoveSack and host of the Let Me Save You 25 Years podcast. Imagine learning from the best without the years of struggle. On my podcast, I sit down with stars like Montel Jordan and Sarah Blakely to share the hard-earned lessons that can save you time and effort on your path to success. Ready to speed up your success story? Listen to Let Me Save You 25 Years with Sean Nelson wherever you get your podcasts.
That was like my peak of the mountain moment, and I, you know, have gone back and forth since then. Yeah. So it's not been perfect in that relationship.
There's a great thing to help with that, which is to see it more clearly. So I had a friend who was born and raised Catholic, and he was asking me, he was like, "Look, so I have a hard time knowing when I'm supposed to sacrifice for others and when I'm supposed to take care of myself." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Oh, cool! I didn't know that God was a sadomasochist." And, you know, he looked at me strange, and I was like, "So you're saying God set up a world where what's right for you isn't right for others, and what's right for others isn't right for you? Like that's some fucked up. That's some devil shit, you know?" Like, and my experience is that when I'm doing something that's truly right for me, it's also truly right for the people around me, and vice versa. When I'm doing something that's truly right for them, it's truly right for me. Mm. And so if I don't feel being right for, like, good for me and good for them, I don't take the action. Mm. The difference is they might not like it.
Yeah.
Or I might not like it. It might not be comfortable in the moment. It might not be nice, mm-hmm. but man, when I do it, I know I'm like, that felt right.
This one is so huge. I haven't fully integrated it. I'm getting there and feeling it. Gosh, I would love to, I don't even know where to begin on this one. You can help me perhaps. That like superficially and maybe even deep, like hurting people's feelings by doing what deeply feels, by being honest and feeling right. And a lot of it has come through in business of like, this isn't the right role or the right place, or I don't want to continue. It's often, I don't want to continue in this relationship has been a lot of it. And I think probably because I set my life up to sacrifice and build, you know, all of those sorts of patterns.
Yeah.
I am just starting to see a longer timeline, which I hadn't, because I was so myopically zoomed in on the moment of firing someone or letting them go. And I was like, this is the end of the story. Like, they're fired. And somewhere inside of me is like, I have consigned them to banishment and death. Right. And I don't know if you could speak to people who maybe feel that, like, how do you widen that timeline? And how do you begin to see that what is deeply right for you is deeply right for another? That's something that I still find myself not 100% having faith in.
Yeah. So the first thing that I notice is that when you talk about it, it tells me that fear is at play, because one of the things that fear does in the mind is it creates false ends. Mm-hmm. So if you want to see through fear, you just kind of like the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, or the Samurai, or the Macedonians, I can't remember. Stoics, they talk about, like, to overcome the fear of death is you feel the entire death process over and over, visualize the entire death process over and over again. And because you're seeing through the false end, you're literally watching your body decompose in the earth and blah, 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 blah. And so it works like that with anything. So the one thing to do is just like look through the false end. Oh, this is the place where I said it's going to all, like, that's it, death sentence. And then go, okay, what happens right after that? What happens right after that? Intellectually, that's a useful one. If you feel the stuff that happens after that, that's also incredibly useful.
Yeah.
As far as doing it. But the other way to look at this is that, there's a way in which you think you have a decision to make, and that's the part that I would question. And so I think there's also like, oh wow, when you get really good at it, what happens is the very first thing that doesn't feel good, you're like, that doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, that doesn't feel good. And then, so it might not go there. So it's like, there's been 20 of those conversations that have been avoided to get to the conversation where you're like, oh, I'm going to fire them. And every one of those conversations are easier to see that it's good for them and good for you. Also, when you're firing somebody, that, like, the way it works in our world is something to the effect of, I've noticed, this is what we needed you to do, and you haven't done it. Mm-hmm. And that tells me that either you don't want the job, which is totally okay, and we want to figure out what you do want, or it means that you aren't able to do the job, which means it's got to feel like shit to you. Like, nobody likes to be in a position where they're failing all the time. And so we want to know how we can get you to a place where you are happy in a job and you feel really great.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's the conversation. That's how it goes. And there's also the ownership of, it also doesn't feel good for us because we love working on a team where everybody is like firing on all cylinders and we feel great about our work and we feel highly functional. Like, that is one of the greatest pleasures that we have. So like, it doesn't good work for us. It's clearly not working for you. Let's figure out how to fix this thing together.
Mm-hmm. Implied in that is a thing that I've tried to expand my beliefs and vision around, which is I've recognized that I don't really believe in people, you know, and like, I don't believe that they're going to be good without me, which, and I see from this perspective how shrinking of an energy it is, how it calls out that dependency in them, how it invites people who perhaps want to engage in that and alienates people who don't want to engage in that, and how that confirms a world that is that. And yeah, just expanding my belief to be like, I believe that there's a beautiful place for you. And if I feel that it's not here, I'm hurting you by trying to force it, because there is somewhere that is beautiful that has been, I'm opening to it and I'm starting to see evidence of it in ways that I just couldn't before.
So this is all related to the like being needed and helping other people. Like, that's all part of the same complex of, right? So if you're actually not needed, you know, and then, so typically what happened is that there was somebody in your life that made you emotionally responsible for them. And so, so you started taking emotional responsibility for people.
Yeah.
Like, this is typically the thing. And in doing so, you made people as incompetent as that person happened to be. And so that you're recreating that pattern over and over again in this way. And the other thing that happens is the more that you treat them that way, the less competent they are or will behave.
Yes.
So that's the other thing, is because they'll start questioning themselves. They're like, well, if he's questioning me, I should question me. I must not be doing it right. Mm-hmm. And then they second guess themselves. And the last thing I ever want is an employee who's constantly second guessing themselves. That's like, whoa, that's horribly ineffective and inefficient. So I think that there's, the reason that that evidence might come slowly is because it's more evidence of your pattern than it is evidence of their capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this really cool trick, if you want to know it, in a business context, where you start off, and it's, I'm going to say it, it's really nuanced to do it well, but it's basically, you know, Vue, which you're familiar with, which is like a big part of our first course, but it's Vue in a meeting. And so the first thing is you say, here's the problem statement, and you just have it in the form of a question, and you have a conversation. Is this the right problem statement? Is the right problem statement, how do we build the best phone ever? Or is the real problem statement or question, excuse me, how do we build the most easy to use phone? Or is it, how do we build the cheapest phone? Like, what's the real? And then you say, what are the criteria for a great solution? Like, oh, okay. So it's done in 18 months. Blah, 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 blah. It like, people want to use it. And you have this solution criteria that you then debate. And then you say, great, okay, go and do it. Mm-hmm. But you don't give them a solution.
Totally different from how I've ever done anything. And I could see the lack of trust that immediately pops up in me, and also how that contributes to every single thing.
Right.
So yeah.
But if you stop and think about it, if you agree that the problem statement is this, and you agree that if all these solution criteria are met, it's going to be a great solution, then either you're going to find out they can't solve the problem, or they're going to solve the problem in a way that pleases you.
Yeah.
Either one is great information to have, because if they can't solve the problem, then you need to find new people.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's that, gosh, there's two directions I want to take this. One is, I'll let you pick and choose. One is loving boundaries, which I thought boundaries had spikes on them and they were harming other people. Yeah. Literally. Yeah, yeah. That was my visual of like, oh, here's my boundary. It's a barbed wire fence with lasers blasting other people.
Right. It's going to make that parent that I was emotionally responsible for get really pissed.
Hurt. Deeply wounding.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh, it was guilt. Huh? Yeah. It was.
Oh, like, yeah.
Like, yeah. Fragile person. Yeah.
Got it. Yeah. and love her a lot.
When you say hurt, yeah, no doubt. But when you say hurt, it, like, don't mistake. Oftentimes that hurt can have aggression in it. Mm. It's just a different kind of aggression.
And we've been able to talk about that lately, which is the deeply repressed anger that can come through at being hurt at someone.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. You can be, exactly. It often comes out as guilt, like guilt trips or something like that. But there's a lot of, and that, like, you can't miss, it's really important to know that that is aggression. Mm. It is anger. Just like an angry person is like, I can't say that I'm hurt. I can't say that I'm scared, so I'm going to get angry. This person says, I can't get angry, so I'm going to say I'm hurt. And there's no, it's the same.
I love
same,
that.
Yeah.
She'll watch this 100%, and that's a gift to you, Mom. I think that's a great thread to pick up.
If she's sitting there and she's listening to this, I'll just say, like, I know you know it. I've never sat with somebody who knows that they might not want to admit it, but everybody knows on some level there's some aggression and
anger
what they're doing.
Yeah. I love that. That's such the missing key. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I won't solve it for her. Okay. So the other one was, so boundaries was the one thing that I wanted to talk about. And then there was something else in the business context. Oh, maybe I'll just briefly mention it, which I love this reframe. There's so many people out there that are trying to build a business so they can sell it. Yeah. And I just listen, you're like, why would I want to put all of this effort into creating a place and a culture and a group of people so that I could sell it for the net present value of the cash flows to someone else? Like, why wouldn't I just want to be there with these people in a culture that I've worked so hard to make? And that shifts everything. Cause if you're building to sell, it's like, you're going to build things that you don't necessarily want to own. You're going to build problems that you don't want to deal with. You're going to build, and then you're going to try to unload it onto somebody else who is silly enough to want those problems.
Right.
As opposed to what you're talking about is like, no, I'm going to build a team that I get to do a problem statement, clarify it, send them loose on it, and then be thrilled with what comes back. Like, that's just a totally different vision and expectation of what is possible inside of a business.
Yeah. My story on this one is kind of a more recent thing that happened where my wife and I were just finished doing this very, very intense retreat. We do this retreat that's like, it's not on the market. It's like, you know, the secret menu. And we call it Groundbreakers, and we do basically 7 days from 7:30 in the morning till 10:30 at night. We work our asses off, and people are getting angry. There's this big emotional breakthroughs, people projecting onto you. It's like, it's tough work any way you look at it. I love it. But we're finished sitting in a hot tub, and my wife and I are talking about a transaction that we could have made when I was a venture capitalist or a little bit before then that would have made it so we never had to work. And we didn't make that transaction. And we were talking about it, and we were saying how grateful we were that we hadn't made that transaction, because we were convinced that we would have stayed married, because at that point we'd already were focused on working together to stay married, but and doing that work. But we didn't think we would have started the business.
Wow.
And I looked at her and I was like, would you sell the business for $1 billion our business is not anywhere worth $1 billion. If it meant that you had to stop doing this, you had to stop doing the work. And she looked, and I thought, and like 10 seconds into, we both went, oh, no, we wouldn't.
Wow.
Like, there was like this moment of like, and the cute end to that story was I came home and I told my girls about that moment. I was like, I just realized this. It makes me really happy about like my life that this is the case. Mm-hmm. And 2 or 3 days later, my 13-year-old comes over and she goes, I'm looking for my $1 billion idea. I'm like, oh, you want to be a billionaire? She goes, no, I want an idea that I wouldn't sell for $1 billion.
That's so beautiful. I love that. That's so incredible. What a reversal. Because I know as I started with the business, I never thought it would work. You know, of course not. Yeah. And then it's like, oh, this is getting to forever sums of money. You know, if I could finagle it or play it. And that was the moment that I lost connection with what I was doing, was when I started to even just subtly think how this could help me get out of work.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the exact phrase that you have, but like, we all work.
Yeah. Everybody works.
Everybody
works. Told to me by a billionaire. Billionaire looks at me, he's like, everybody works, Joe.
Yeah. And so to, instead of, like you said, trying to get $1 billion so that you can then do the next thing, to like do the thing that you wouldn't give up for $1 billion.
Yeah.
And if you do the rest of the peripheral thing around opening up to connection, opening your heart, that is going to create value for other people. It's impossible that it doesn't. So yeah, that just these, I find that I struggle to listen to some other more tactical business gurus that I used to, because the foundational value base is like, get more money, which doesn't, I don't know, that takes me away from the core of what I want, of what thrills me and excites me and gets me. Yeah.
For me, I feel like this is like the head, heart, and gut connection. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not going to be satisfied unless all three are at play. Mm-hmm. And the head part of business is like, how do, like, I see business as an art form in which the color or the tone is revenue, right? So mm-hmm. like, if I'm playing music, then I have to use notes. If I'm painting, I have to use color pigment. If I'm doing the art of business, I have to use revenue has to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And so I want to take that in consideration the same way an artist would take the consideration of pigment or tones. I want to be obsessed with it on some level, the way that they are, but it's not the whole thing. It's, you know, it's also like, I'm also want the vibe and the, like, everything else that makes great art happen.
Yeah.
And so to me, so as a matter of fact, this is what got me into the business. So I was sitting on a bed, sitting still 7 years, meditating silently, going into debt. That was my reality. And at some point I was like, oh, I need to make a living. It's time to have a kid. I'm going to become a venture capitalist. I'm like 34 years old. And it's a little more complicated, but basically that's what happened. And I knew that my number one driver, the thing that drove me is self-discovery. That's it's always been my passion. And if I was going to make business work, it had to be a avenue of self-discovery. It had to be, or I just couldn't do it. And what I noticed is all those business tools, if you add self-discovery to it, become more effective. If you add connection to it, it becomes more effective. Whatever they say, like, you need a product. Let me think of one other thing, you know, like, you need a product that people that offer enough value so that people will pay more for it. You should assume 30% of the value that you offer is what they'll pay for it so that they can keep their 60%, whatever that would be like. I'd be like, yeah, okay. So now how do I add connection to that?
Okay.
I'm like, oh, I need a product that people connect to.
And here's the tactic.
And I need to connect with the product. I need to connect with the product. I also need to connect with the customer. What is it that's really fucking driving you? What is it like, and I want to be in a conversation with them where they discover something about themselves and I discover something about me and our business. And we're learning together and growing. Like, that's what's going to get me the great product. I mean, it's why our courses, like, we have a 98% completion rate on our fucking courses. That didn't come because of because I was like, where's the connection? Where's the listening? Where's the, like, all those things that I know drive self-discovery in me also improve all of those business, every one of those business insights, that business wisdom is improved if you also, because all business is like, think about it this way. Business is basically people's ideas and people's relationships. That's all your business is. And it's almost anybody's business. Maybe there's like some trucks involved that you like, there's some CapEx, but most of it, like, none of it works without those two things. And so the atomic structure of a business is basically the meetings and the decisions that are made, because those represent the ideas that get executed and the relationships. If you do those two things right, they're great. And how to do those two things, that's a psychological problem. That's not a, like, a business problem. And so if you add to all that business wisdom, that psychological wisdom, then you know, your business just thrives and it's fun and it's enjoyable. And
wow. You're making me realize that I'm going to do a retrospective, a postmortem, if you will, and look at the when and how did I fall out of connection, you know, with the customer or the product or the videos or anything. And it's not like I've totally lost it, but there were subtle moments where it something lost, and it was, yeah, get me out of here, was sort of what I was doing.
Yeah, that's like, yeah. So I was, so one of the mechanisms that I'll, when I go into a business, one of the mechanisms that I'll talk about is how enjoyment is the best gauge of efficiency. Mm-hmm. So we somehow know that an efficient car is a car that uses less energy, but an efficient business is just fast. We think mm-hmm. that's an efficient business, is one that's fast. I don't know why on earth we think that, but it's a typical thing. And if you want efficiency in a business, the best mark is enjoyment, because it means that it's giving you energy instead of taking energy away from you. And so if every day business is giving you energy, then why would you want to sell it? Why would you want to stop? So if I'm not enjoying anything in my business, that's my first thing. That's where I address it. And usually it means other people aren't enjoying it either. So it's a really compassionate thing to address. And when we look at the things that aren't being enjoyed, then we look for ways to improve under the guise not of like, how do we make an extra blah, blah, blah dollars, which is going to, might be part of it. Absolutely will be part of it. But it's also, how do we enjoy this thing more? And so I was sitting with another creator at this offsite thing that we did, and he's just like, I fucking hate YouTube. I was talking about, and he's got a good YouTube channel and he's made a lot out of it, but he's like, I fucking hate it. And I was talking about, how do you make all your meetings enjoyable meetings? And he's like, I can't make those enjoyable. I just can't fucking do it. And I was like, okay, here we go. And so we picked apart every reason that he couldn't do it. And we looked at the whole thing, and it like changed, broke it down. Like, wait, this person would have to go, this would have to happen. All of a sudden he had a vision of
what he's
how
gonna have to do.
It would be enjoyable. And it's totally taken his YouTube channel to the next level.
Yeah.
Because especially in that process, it's like people are feeling his enjoyment in the, you know what I mean? I use that all the time with like people who run some of the most notable companies in this. And when they start figuring out how to enjoy every one of their meetings, there's less meetings, it's more effective, everything gets much, much better.
There's a lot for me to do there. A lot for me to unpack in that one. I've listened to your podcast on that, but I appreciate you just taking the time with me.
It's a definitely different way to look at the problem.
Beautiful. I've took some other particular things. Let me just take a quick look at what I'd written. Confident, vulnerable, listening, persuading. Okay. This is one that maybe aligns.
Cut it out, but you just said confident versus vulnerable, which is invulnerable and vulnerable are very different things. To say it. Like, to me, confidence is, you can be very confident in your vulnerability.
Yes. Yes.
I've seen you do it 3 times on the podcast already, at least. Mm-hmm. So confidence, and as a matter of fact, invulnerability to me, like if I have a business quote adversary, which I don't have anymore, but when I was a venture capitalist, I had a business adversary and they were like invulnerable. I was like, oh, I got you. It's like, you're easy.
Mm.
You're so easy because you're so predictable. Yeah, I know exactly what you're going to do. It's very weak. People get intimidated by them, but it's a really interesting thing. But you can be confident and vulnerable and confident and invulnerable, just to say it. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. No, I switched the word on purpose. Because I was like, these are not opposites. Yeah, these are. Yeah,
cool.
Here's one that I was wrestling with. So this is preparing and trying to do well versus letting go completely. I've heard you say that you'll like walk on stage in front of people who have paid you and you'll be like, I don't know what I'm going to say today, which I would love to arrive at that point. Candidly, I have my list here. I thought of different ways this conversation could go. I tried to highlight the piece that I thought the audience would be most interested in first.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, and this seems to be a tension that I feel when I make videos, which is I do have some over the years I've done this, intuitive knowledge of what people respond to and like.
Yes.
Which is not identical to what I would do if I wasn't putting something out for an audience. And so I'm curious how to balance like trying to do well with just like letting go. Maybe they're not opposite. Maybe I'm misconceiving even the problem statement.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like if it's intuitive, you'll know it. when you're doing it. Mm-hmm. To me, the way that I, at this, so I remember the way that I arrived here. The way that I arrived here was that I was supposed to give this big presentation at this venture capital meeting. They lost the presentation. And so, but they're like, and off you go. And I was on stage, no presentation, 45 minutes in front of 500 venture capitalists. And I was like, oh shit. So I just started talking and I remembered some of the notes and then I just, you know, the, some of the slides I remembered. And so I just spoke and it was the most well-received thing I'd ever done.
Wow.
And it was because I was just very present and I was very connected with the audience. I was like, oh, the only thing I can rely on here is my own presence and my own connection.
Mm.
And I think like, yeah, there was, anyway, there's a, like some good jokes came out and there was interaction and I asked a lot of questions and it was, and so that's how I, that's the first time that I found out about this, like, oh goodness, like this is, and it was so much more fun for me. And then I like went too far of like lack of preparation and then that didn't particularly work. And then I went back to a little more preparation. So there's this kind of been this balance, but as the pendulum has swung back and forth, what I've noticed is that I need less preparation. So not, there's two changes happening. One is I pendulate between preparation and not preparation. I'm sorry. I have fluctuated between preparation and not preparation, but as I fluctuated, that's what's actually made it so that I need less preparation.
Yeah.
Because I have tried the things that nobody else would look at, nobody else would want to see. And oh, wait, they do. Mm. Wait, what? What is it about that one that was interesting? That's something I didn't know. Mm. And so those lack of preparation moments have been experiments where I'm learning something that I couldn't learn any other way.
Sure.
And so, because there's magic that happens in that lack of preparation and then that becomes part of the preparation. And then, and so that's how it works. I do, you've seen me do this rapid fire coaching. Of course, there's no way I can prepare for that outside of like a life of coaching. And, but oftentimes in that moment will come an exercise that then becomes part of a course.
So cool.
And it can only happen because I'm addressing an immediate need by deeply listening. And so the other thing I'll say is that as you're learning to listen more and more and more preparation, my experience is preparation will become less and less and less important.
That is what happened. And I just didn't realize that that was what happened throughout the course of my life was, you know, I used to need, what am I going to say when I start a conversation? What am I going to answer this question with? What I'm going to, you know, I had to have my rote decision tree answers in order just to be okay. But eventually you're in new territory. Yes. And then just like you said, it was the new territory that became the holy cow. Like, you know, that's a mindset or a vibe or a way of being that became another lesson. And just to spend more time in that new, as you develop and get older, it's like, oh, that sounds so much more relaxing and fun and creative.
The other thing about it is like, without that, man, you're going to be Gilligan's Island, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you have a set of people who have listened to you. Now there's probably another younger set of people who will listen to your old stuff and you know, that you're talking to them. But if you want to keep your audience over a period of time, then you have to be shifting and evolving because they are, or your teaching didn't work. Then otherwise, like whatever you taught them did not end up working at all.
Yeah.
And so like that evolution is a required thing. And it's the same thing with business. You like, you have to continue to evolve. And the only way to do that is to experiment. And the best way to experiment is to not have the answer in mind.
Yeah. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. And it's exactly where I hate to go, and it's where I am going, which is not having the answer. So, I do want to touch because there's. I would be remiss if I didn't touch on boundaries because that has been such. You know, we talked a little bit about me.
Yeah,
loving boundaries have been such a shift for me, and seeing them as loving for myself, and ultimately over a long enough timeline, as loving for the other person as well, as for many reasons. But I'm able to show up more authentically loving because I'm. Usually an obligation, which I thought was love, which was, you know, doing something for you because this is what I'm supposed to, given my role, and to show gratitude, which your work has also helped me feel gratitude, I would say. Yeah. Like being grateful sucked for years and years and years. I hated being grateful. It was the worst. because there was so much obligation tied into gratitude. And that unlock of like, oh my gosh, one of the sweetest joys of life was just, it was, I did not like it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So thank you for your guidance around that.
How did you find it? How did that unravel for you?
So simple. Don't think of what you're grateful for. Feel gratitude first.
Great. Yeah. Okay.
And then in one sentence, max, say the thing. Don't explain it. And then I was getting like, I'm grateful for like all, you know, what I've been able to build and what I've earned. You know, this is when I think of what I'm grateful for.
Exactly.
And when I feel, I mean, this is what I cry for every day. It's just like the sky, you know, like the ground, just these profoundly, the depth of my gratitude for them far eclipses anything. I didn't know it. I didn't know it. And I would never have said that at Thanksgiving dinner when they were going around and everybody.
Right. Yeah. That's interesting. So there's something that happened like with one of my clients around this, which I think maybe might rhyme with something that happened for you, which was like, you should be grateful. There was a lot of you should be grateful. Like, look at everything we have, but you should be grateful, which is such a denial of an emotional experience and in a weird way, a guilt trip. And so they also had this hard time and actually had the exact same experiences as soon as they had it come from a body place where they actually had the feeling. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's lovely. The thing I love about gratitude on top of that is it just admits that there's something beyond you.
Yeah. That was the other thing I could not accept. I could not accept something bigger than me. That was a hard one.
Yeah, exactly. Cause that control thing that, to feel safe. Totally makes sense. Yeah.
But cool. I interrupted. I don't know if you want to.
Oh, no, that was it. No, that was it. Yeah.
Great.
Cool. So but you asked about boundaries.
Boundaries.
You
want me to, please.
Yeah. So the short version on boundaries is that a great boundary is one that immediately makes you love the person that you're drawing the boundary with more. So that's the quick version. So if you think about any person who's like, just you think about it, who's like deeply loving, whether it's like Gandhi or Martin Luther King, or just like that really loving mom, you'll notice they are all really boundaried people. Mother Teresa, they have very clear boundaries. And so we think we get told that to be loving, like we get is to be obligated, is to be kind, is to be nice, is to be obligated. But loving is a felt sense of like, oh, my heart is open towards you. Mm-hmm. And if something's getting in the way of that open-heartedness, then the boundary needs to be drawn or you're going to close your heart. So that like, that's just how it is. And so, so that's what the boundary is. The other thing that's really useful about boundaries is as much as possible, make it so that it's not asking them to be different. It's saying how you're going to react differently to a behavior. So, when you yell at me, I'm going to leave. I'll be back in 20 minutes and you're welcome. We're welcome to try again. But if you yell at me, then I'll leave again. I'll be back again in 20 minutes. Like, it's something where you're not asking them to be different, because then you're in fear and you're in a control. You're trying to control one another.
Yeah.
And so you're not giving the person their autonomy. And so the fight will just continue on and on and on. So you really want to be able to say, this is how I'm going to react to you. And always give an out, always give like a, and I'll come back at this time. And I'll like, I'm not going to abandon you. I'm not going to disengage with you completely. Mm-hmm. Now, occasionally it is, I'm going to disengage with you completely. And that's when you're just like, oh, I'm not in relationship with this person. So I'm not going to pretend I'm in relationship with them anymore. And so that's what loving boundaries is all about. And it's literally found by going, what do I need to say to this person that will allow me to love them more, no matter what their reaction is?
Yeah.
Whether they yell at me or it just like immediately allows me to open my heart to them.
Yes. And what I found myself doing was that, what do I have to do to get to like the love for them is I was making these tiny little compromises. I was like, well, maybe you just don't do X. And it's like where I need to be was so far over here because I'd spent so many years.
Yeah.
That guide of what is the distance or space or time I need to genuinely feel and return to the love that I have for you was a very scary, heuristic, but ultimately so gorgeous. Because if I'd taken it piecemeal, I never would have arrived. Don't visit for a while. And this was my mom. Like it was, and I don't know how long. I still love you, but I can't, you know? And so we took a long time where she didn't visit, and that was hard for her. And it was hard for me for it to be hard for her.
Yes.
But I came back to love eventually. I was like, oh my God. Yeah.
I did the same thing with my parents, but I didn't know it. Like what I said to my parents was, if you want me to come over, I need you not to criticize me. Because why would I ever go to a place where I know I'm going to be criticized? It makes no sense. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand at the moment. It was like one of the teaching lessons for me about the boundaries. They just basically didn't talk to me for 2 years. And then they talked to me and they didn't criticize me. And we had this really nice interaction. And I was like, oh shit. Like what a lovely thing that just occurred. And softened me towards them, softened them towards me. And I was like, oh, that was the beginning of me learning boundaries.
Wow.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I want to talk about the connection course, because that's going to come out shortly after we release this. You'll have your next cohort, which is something. Yeah. Cool. So that's something that I did. And a little bit of background, I'll share the story of how it impacted my relationship with my mom, since I've talked a bit about that. For years, I'd been doing things that were moving me in the right direction, for sure. And it was one of emotional caretaking on my end, not bringing my needs into the relationship, trying to solve her fears by earning more money and sending it to the, you know, like things like that. And then being resentful and angry when the things that I did that I had verbal indication would have solved the problem didn't solve the actual problem.
Yeah, totally.
And, you know, every call was me trying to fix her. And I was addicted to it. And I think there was a degree to which she was addicted to it.
Yeah.
And so I'd made a lot of strides, but I'd also gone in the direction of not loving boundaries. I was like an angry boundaries. I was like, you fucking, you did this, and yelling at her. And so I was in the connection course.
Right.
And I'd wounded her in ways and been over the top, and it got to the vulnerability part, which was like, can you vulnerably share what it feels like? So, okay, I'm working on this. Next call, we're there. I say something and she replies in a way to which I feel totally unheard and totally unseen. And like, you know, I know that you don't, whatever, like me or love me or care, you know. And I was allowed her to say it and said, can I share something with you? I feel the core of who I am hates how much I love you. And I feel so unseen and unheard when you can't feel that for me, because I don't, you know, haven't seen you or something like that. And the way that I shared it, the place that I went to, she didn't enter into defensiveness. She didn't double down in a shame spiral. She didn't. And she later said, she said, I don't know. It was just sort of the way that you did it. Something changed.
Yeah.
And since then, it hasn't, you know, it's been a steady climb of just like, oh, there's more opportunity for her to see me. And things that I've been saying and harping on for years, and don't you see that this pattern is that pattern?
Yeah.
She's independently experiencing and noticing. And I find myself able to authentically connect in more places, which is nice. So all that to say, I think your work is amazing. I hope that people check out the podcast. The connection course is coming up. I can let you talk a little bit about the structure of it.
Yeah.
But it had a really valuable, useful, unpredicted impact in a number of core relationships in my life. And so I think that we're gonna have a code or something like there where I don't know exactly what it'll be. But I do heartily recommend it to people who are listening and have enjoyed this conversation.
Awesome. Thanks. Yeah. Just out of curiosity, did you do the connection course with your mom?
I did it with my brother. And so that was another, a lot shifted there, a lot everywhere. You have helped, contributed to the unraveling and reconstruction of several core relationships in my life.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I'm so glad to hear that. It's such a joy to know that the work that we're doing has that effect. You know, I get the letters Like, I think since I started this business, I think I cry like twice as much because I get so many letters, like I hear the one that I got recently that I just loved was somebody was like, yeah, I know that you help a lot of people, but I just want you to know that you help my kids.
Mm.
That one killed me. The connection course itself is, I think it's 5 2-hour things and then a rapid fire coaching thing with me. So I think it's 6 altogether things. We really tried to create that course in such a way that it requires nothing of anybody but to show up. Mm-hmm. Like there's no homework. There's outside of like have conversations, which you're going to have anyways. Mm-hmm. So it's just very easy to use. It's very experiential. There's not somebody talking at you. It's stuff that you can apply to your life right away, which is everything that we do. We want whatever you're doing to apply it right away, like you did. You can, boom, change your relationship with this person, learn how to have difficult conversations, learn how to have conflict, and then go and utilize that right away. Conflict mm-hmm. that's productive instead of destructive. And so that's basically it. Most all of the work is done in partners where you sit down with one other human being and you do some experiments. It's not exercises, it's experiments, because we really know that it's important that people say, okay, I'm doing the experiment now. What do I think about it? It doesn't matter what Joe thinks about it. It doesn't matter what Charlie thinks about it. What matters is like, how did this register in me? What did I learn? And so we really do the whole thing as like just basically a series of experiments. Here's some experiments that you're going to run with this person. They're going to make you uncomfortable. Maybe they're going to make you happy. Maybe they're a whole bunch of different things. And then you get to learn. And so it's very much like, the way I think about it is very much like traveling, you know, like if you like go backpacking through Southeast Asia, you're going to learn a whole bunch of stuff about yourself and about cultures and about people, because you're going and finding territories and things that you haven't looked at before. And there's nothing, all the experiences designed in the connection course, maybe some people have done 10% of them, maybe. So you're going to just gonna, it's like this travel inside of your own psyche and inside of the human psyche. And it's all these experiences that teach you a tremendous amount. And what's interesting about it for me is that people get such different things out of it. There's a lot of healing of relationships, no doubt, but there's just so many, like one person's like, holy crap. Like I sell 30% more because I'm actually connecting with people. And, you know, so all these different weird things happen from it. But it's based not only in the connection of into others, but it's really based into like, how do you more deeply connect with yourself?
Yeah. Which was what I was able to do in that interaction with my mom. Instead of the savior flight to her experience, fix her experience. It was like, oh, okay, this is where I'm at. And it's worth saying that you can join alone and you guys have people that you can be partnered with.
Yes.
And you could, you know, it'll be someone you don't know, but you can take the advice like I did and provide it. Or the experience and apply it outside. Or where I think it could be really useful is you can do it with someone that you are in some kind of relationship with.
Yes.
And it's got a really good forcing function with the cohort way of like, we're going to sit down and we're going to do these things that we will not otherwise
do. That's right.
Do.
It's why we only do it in a cohort, because it's, you know, what I would say is just, If you want to do it with somebody and you're highly triggered by them, don't do it with them the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Come back the second time. You want to have some, maybe there's some trigger, but there's both people are willing to have, you know, to discover together is really a prerequisite if you're going to choose someone to do it with. You can do it with somebody, just don't do the interaction. You're like, do it with strangers and then you can do it at the same time. That's fine too. Mm-hmm. Another alternative, but just definitely don't bring someone who's just like, he's like your psychological like
nemesis
or kryptonite. Exactly. You don't want that.
Yeah. Cool. Well, there'll be a link in the description. I'm working with your team on a discount code. So that'll be down there for anybody who wants to join.
Thank you.
And thank you, Joe. This has been a wonderful conversation. I've got some unpacking to do.
Awesome. What a pleasure.
Awesome.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.